You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 28th of December, 1921. It was not my intention in yesterday's lecture to single out certain types of illnesses or to specify differing degrees of health, nor is it my aim to do so in today's continuation of our subject. I merely wish to bring to your notice how important it is for the teacher to learn to recognize both healing and harmful influences in the lives of his pupils. A real educator, above all else, must have acquired an insight into the entire human organization. He must not allow abstract educational theories or methods to let him deviate from his natural, or as one could also call it, from his instinctive, intuitive insights. Abstract theories will only hamper him in his efforts. He must be able to look at his children free from any preconceptions. In Middle Europe, the following quotation is frequently heard. I do not know whether it is known in the West. Quote, there is only one health, but there are many, many illnesses. Close quote. Footnote, because of the large number of participants at this conference, Rudolf Steiner had to give each lecture twice. He stipulated that the non-German-speaking members, many of whom came from England, should attend the repeat lecture, which was translated into English by George Kaufman. End of footnote. This saying, however, in which so many people believe, does not really stand up to a proper scrutiny, for the human being is so individualized that each person, and also each child, has his own specific state of health, or represents an individual modification of the general idea of health. One might just as well coin the phrase, there are as many different kinds of health and illness as there are people in the world. This fact alone is an indication of how we must always consider the individual nature of each person. But this is only possible if we learn to look upon the human being in his totality. In every person, soul and spiritual forces are always interacting with physical forces, just as in water, hydrogen and oxygen react upon each other. And in man, as he stands there before us, it is as little possible to observe directly his soul and spiritual being separately from his physical and material existence as it is to observe hydrogen and oxygen separately in water. In order to recognize the true relationship between the soul spiritual part of man and his physical nature, one must first get to know them intimately. But this is not possible by the ordinary means of knowledge alone. Nowadays, one is accustomed to look upon man from two points of view. The one is reached through the study of physiology and anatomy, where a picture is arrived at which is not based upon the living human being at all, but only upon his corpse. For man's soul and spiritual counterparts are there excluded. The other is that of psychology, the study of man's inner life. But the psychologist can only form abstractions, only thin and cold concepts in these naturalistic and intellectualistic times. The investigator seems to warm up only when he tries to plumb the depths of human emotions and will impulses. These, however, he cannot grasp in their true essence either. In a vague way, he can only see in them surging waves welling up from within. It is quite obvious that by producing only cold, thin, and pale conceptions regarding the human psyche, no true sense of reality can be achieved. What I am about to say may well appear paradoxical to present-day attitudes, but it is nevertheless true. People today adopt a materialistic attitude because for them the spirit has become too attenuated, too far distant, and consequently, what they can observe of man's inner life no longer bears any sense of reality. The very people who live in the most abstract thoughts have become the greatest materialists in our cultural epoch. Our contemporary kind of thinking, and thinking is a spiritual activity, turns people into materialists. On the other hand, people who are relatively untouched by the scientific thinking of today, people whose minds turn more to external material happenings, are the ones who can sense some of the mysteries underlying outer processes. Our scientific thinking of today hardly leaves any room for life's mysteries. Its thoughts are thin, transparent, and above all horribly clear-cut, and consequently not anchored in the realities of life. Material processes in nature, on the other hand, are full of mysteries. These need not be approached with the clarity of intellectual thoughts only, for they also evoke a sense of wonder in us. In this way, our feelings too become engaged. Therefore, people who have not become influenced by today's sterile thoughts, people who have kept aloof from the rigorous discipline of a scientific training, are more open to the mysteries of external material processes. However, there is a certain danger in that their longing to find the spirit in what they thus behold in nature makes them look upon the spiritual as if it, too, were only matter. They become spiritualists. Modern scientific thinking will not produce spiritualists, but materialists. A natural openness toward the material world, on the other hand, will easily produce a spiritualistic attitude. And herein lies a strange paradox, typical of our times. However, neither a materialistic thinking nor a spiritualistic outlook on life will produce a true picture of the human being. This can be gained only by discriminating how in every single organ and in the entire human being, the soul and spiritual element in man interweaves with what is physical and material. People today do talk about soul and spirit. They talk about the physical aspect of man. Then they philosophize about the relationship between the two members. Detailed theories have been put forth by learned people. But these theories, however ingenious they may be, cannot touch reality, simply because reality can be found only if one is able to perceive how the soul and spiritual element and the physical material element of the entire human being completely interpenetrate each other. If one looks at the results of today's investigations, both in physiology and in psychology, one cannot help but find them both nebulous and gray. Nowadays, when one person looks upon another, he feels that he is confronting a complete unity. This impression is due to the fact that the other person is neatly wrapped up in his skin. One does not generally realize that this apparent oneness is the result of the working together of the most diversifying organs. And if one makes the statement that this unity must not be taken for granted, opponents rise soon enough to accuse one of destroying the concept of the unity of the human being, which they consider to be fundamental. However, their conception of a human oneness remains merely an abstract thought, unless they are able to build it up by harmonizing the manifold members of the human being into one organism. And when people look inward, they sum up all that lives within them with the little word, capital I. Eminent people such as John Stuart Mill had to make strenuous efforts in formulating theories about what is contained within this inner feeling of identity, which expresses itself through the word I. But only pause to consider how nebulous such an idea of a point like I really is. You will soon see that with this concept you are no longer grasping concrete reality. In the German language, three letters suffice to form this little word, ich, I-C-H, and in English, even fewer. People hardly manage to get beyond the outer meaning of these letters, with the result that today's knowledge of man remains nebulous, no matter whether you look upon his inner life or upon his physical constituents. It is the ability of seeing the spiritual and physical working together which fructifies one's efforts at comprehending man. There are many people today who experience inner satisfaction at hearing Goethe's words, matter in spirit, spirit in matter. It is good if these words make people happy, for they certainly express a truth. But for anyone who has made a habit of seeing spirit and matter working together everywhere, such words express a mere triviality, for they extol something which is obvious. The fact that so many people receive this somewhat theoretical dictum with such acclaim only goes to show that they no longer experience its underlying reality. Theoretical explanations usually hide the loss of concrete inner experiences. We can find an example of this in history when looking at the theories about the Holy Communion, theories which were widely discussed from the very point of time when people no longer could experience its reality. Usually theories are formulated in order to explain what is no longer experienced in practice. The attitude of mind expressed so far will be helpful to anyone who wishes to practice education as an art. It will enable him to gain a concrete picture of man's manifold members, instead of his having to work with some vague idea of a human oneness. To him, a picture of man as an organic whole will also emerge, but in it he will recognize how the different members are working together in harmony. Such a picture inevitably leads to what I have indicated in my book titled Riddles of the Soul, namely to the discovery of man's three fundamental parts, each different from the others, both in functions and in character. Already externally, the head organization appears very different from, let us say, the organism of the limbs and metabolic system. I link these two latter systems together because the metabolism shows its real nature when the human being is active in his limbs. In morphological terms, one can look upon the digestive system as a kind of continuation, even if only inwardly, of the human being in movement. There exists an intimate kinship between the limb and the digestive systems. For instance, the metabolism is more lively when the limbs are active. This kinship could be demonstrated in detail. Here I am merely indicating it. Because of their close affinity, I group these two systems together, although when each one is looked at individually, they also represent certain polarities. Now let us look at the human figure, beginning with the head. For the moment we will ignore the hair, which in any case grows away from the head, and which, because it is a dead substance, really remains outside the living head organization. (Human hair is really a most interesting substance, but further details would only lead us away from our main considerations. The head is encased by the skull, which is formed most powerfully at the periphery, whereas the soft and living parts are enclosed within. Let us now compare the head with its opposite pole, with the limb system. Here we find the tubular bones enclosing the marrow, which is generally not looked upon as being of equal importance for the entire organism as the brain substance, which is enclosed by the skull. On the other hand, here the most important parts, the muscles, are found attached from outside, and from this point of view, we can see a polarity characteristic of human nature. This polarity consists of the nerves and senses, mainly centered in the head, I say mainly, but not exclusively so, and the metabolism, which is localized in the metabolic and limb system. Despite this polarity, the human being is, of course, a unity. At this point, we must not be tempted into making schemes, dividing the human being into three parts, which we then define as the nerves and senses organization, a second part which will be mentioned shortly, and finally the metabolic and limb organization, as if these parts ever could exist separately. It is not like that at all. Metabolic activities as well as muscular activities are constantly going on in the head, and yet we can say that the head is the center of the nerves and senses organization. Conversely, the digestive limb system is also permeated by forces emanating from the head. But nevertheless, we can call it the seat of the metabolic limb system. Midway between these two regions, we find what one can call the rhythmic system of man, which is located in the chest. Here the most fundamental rhythms take place, namely those of breathing and blood circulation. Each follows its own speed. The breathing rhythm, visible in a person's breathing, is slower, and that of the blood circulation, which can be felt as the pulse beat, is quicker. This rhythmic organization acts as mediator between the other two poles. It would be tempting to go into further detail, but as we have come together to study the principles and methods of Waldorf education, I must refrain from doing so. However, if you can look upon the chest organization from the point of view just indicated, you will find in every single one of its parts, be it in the formation of the skeleton or in that of the inner organs, a transition between the head organization and the metabolic and limb system. Such is the picture which emerges if we observe the human being according to his own inner configuration, instead of accepting foggy notions about a human unity. But this is not all, for we are also led to an understanding of the various functions taking place in the human being. And here I wish to give you an example. One could quote countless examples, but this one must suffice in order to show how important it is for a real educator to follow the directions here indicated. Let us imagine that a person suffers from sudden outbursts of temper. Such eruptions may already occur in childhood, and then a good teacher must find ways of dealing with them. Anyone following the usual methods of physiology and anatomy might include in his considerations also the psychological effects in such a person. Furthermore, he may take into account that when someone is in a state of extreme anger, there is an excess of gall secretion. However, these two aspects, the physical and psychological aspects, are not generally seen as the two sides of the same phenomenon. The soul and spiritual aspect of anger and the physical one of an overactive secretion of bile are not looked upon as a unity. In the case of a normal person, the bile is, of course, a necessary ingredient of the nutritive process. In an angry person, this gall activity reaches an imbalance, and if left to himself, such a person will finally suffer from jaundice, as you all know. If we consider both the soul spiritual and the physical aspects, we can see how a tendency toward a certain illness may develop. But this alone is not yet enough to judge human nature. For while in the metabolism, bile is secreted, in the head organization, an accompanying but polar opposite process is taking place. Unless we realize that while bile is secreted, at the same time an opposite process is also taking place in the head organization, we are not observing human nature fully. For in the head, a milk-like sap produced in the remaining parts of the body is being absorbed. If in an abnormal case too much bile is secreted into the metabolism, the head organization will try to fill itself with too much of this milk-like liquid, with the result that when the temper has cooled down, the person concerned feels as if his head were bursting. And while an excess of bile secretion will cause the milky sap to flow into the head, the face of such a person may turn quite blue once the temper has cooled down. If we study not only the outer forms of bones and organs, but also the organic processes involved, we certainly can find a polarity between the nerves and senses organization centered in the head and the limb and metabolic system. Between these two lives the rhythmic system with its lung and heart activities, which always regulate and mediate between the two outer poles. If we keep our images mobile, avoiding a too simplistic approach, which pictures the various organs always at rest, possibly in order to make accurate and sharply outlined illustrations of them. We cannot help being captivated by the multifarious relationships and the constant interplay which is taking place within these three members of the human being. If we look at the rhythmical activity of breathing, we can see how in breathing, the thrust of inhalation is led to the cerebrospinal fluid. While receiving these breathing rhythms, this fluid passes on the vibrations right up to the brain fluid, which fills the various cavities of the brain. This, in quotes, lapping against the brain caused by rhythmic breathing stimulates the human being to become active in his nerves and senses organization. There is a constant passing on of the rhythms resulting from the process of breathing via the vertebral canal into the brain fluid. Thus the stimuli activated by the breathing constantly strive toward the head region. If we look in a downward direction, we see how rhythmical breathing, in a certain way, becomes more pointed, more excited, in quotes, in the rhythmical beating of the pulse, and how the blood circulation affects the metabolism with each outgoing breath. That is, while the brain and cerebrospinal fluid pushes downward. If we look at the process of breathing and blood circulation with living and artistically sensitive insight, we can follow the effects of the pulsing blood both upon the nerves and senses organization and the metabolic limb system. We see how, on the one side, the processes of breathing and blood circulation reach up into the brain, that is, into the head region, and on the other into the diametrically opposite direction, into the metabolic limb system. If in this way we gradually attain a living picture of man, we can really make progress in our investigations. We can form conceptions which are in full accord with the nature of man's middle system. Such conceptions may not be simple enough to be made into diagrams, but schemes and diagrams in any case are always problematic when it comes to an understanding of the ever-weaving and flowing elements of human nature. When, in the early days of our anthroposophical endeavors, we were still moving among theosophical circles, permit me to mention this here, we were faced time and time again with all kinds of diagrams, generously equipped with all kinds of data. Everything seemed to fit into elaborate yet neat schematic ladders, high enough for anyone to climb into the highest regions of existence. Some members seemed to look upon such diagrammatic ladders as a kind of spiritual gym equipment, with the aid of which they hoped to reach Olympic heights. Everything was neatly enclosed in boxes. Such things made one's limbs twitch convulsively. They were hardly bearable for anyone who knows that in order to get hold of the ever-mobile nature of the human being supersensibly, one must keep one's ideation flexible and alive. These fixed habits of thinking made one wish to run away. Well, what matters is that in one's quest of real knowledge of man, one must always keep one's thinking and ideation, or ideation, mobile. And then one can advance yet another step. If now one tries to build up mental images of how this rhythm between breathing and blood circulation becomes modified and metamorphosed in the upper regions, one is led to the following conception, which I shall sketch on the blackboard, not as a fixed scheme, but merely as an indication, and there's a drawing. Let this thick line represent the mental picture of some kind of rope, which is to help us to picture in quite a rough and ready manner the processes going on in our breathing and blood circulation. This is one way, so one could say, of getting hold of what exists beyond the material blood, in the much finer and imponderable substance of the etheric nerves. If, now, using one's mental imagery, one goes further by turning one's gaze from the chest organization upward, one feels inwardly compelled to, quote, fray out, close quote, as it were, one's images, to transform them into fine threads which are interweaving and forming a delicate network. In this way, one will succeed in grasping with one's mental imagery, now turned in an upward direction and modified, something which is actually happening outwardly and materially. One finds that one simply has to fray out these thick cords into threads. Imagining this process, one gradually comes to the experience of the white, fibrous brain substance which lies under the gray matter. In one's mental imagery, one becomes as mobile as the very processes which are pervading human nature. If you look at the creation of man with the reverence it deserves, you will not oversimplify his intricate organization by calling it a nature-given unity. And if, when looking at his chest region, you form mental images of coarse and rope-like shapes, which become more refined as you approach the region of the head, until they fray out into simple threads, you begin to reach actual material reality. You find your imagination outwardly confirmed by the physical nerve fibers and by the way in which they interweave. Directing your image-making activity in the opposite direction downward, you will find it quite impossible to split up or fray out your mental images into fine threads, to be eventually woven into some kind of texture, as seen externally in the nervous system. Such threads simply vanish away. You lose all trace of them. Otherwise, you would be led astray into forming images which no longer corresponded to external reality. For if you follow the way the brain continues downward into the spinal cord, through the 12 dorsal vertebrae, through the lumbar and sacral vertebrae, and so on, you find that the nerve substance, which now is white on the outside and gray inside, gradually dissolves away toward the region of the metabolism. Somehow it becomes impossible to imagine the nerves continuing downward. We cannot achieve a true and comprehensive picture of man unless our images are capable of undergoing transformations. We must keep our imagery mobile. If we look in an upward direction, our mental pictures will be different from those we find when looking downward. It is possible to recreate in one's imagery the mobility characteristic of human nature. This is the beginning of an artistic activity, which eventually will lead the investigator to what he finds outwardly in physical man. In this way, one avoids the schism resulting from first looking at the material world outside, and then forming abstract conceptions about it. Instead, one really dives down into human nature. One's conceptions become alive, and they remain in harmony with what actually exists in a human being. There is no other way of gaining insight into man's true being, which is an essential prerequisite in the art of education. In order to know man, one has to become inwardly mobile, and then one will rightly discover how these three members of the human organization work together in order to bring about a healthy equilibrium. One will learn to recognize how a disturbance of this equilibrium leads to all kinds of illnesses. One will be able to discriminate in a living way between what leads toward health or illness in human life. This becomes especially important when one includes the entire span of human life in one's considerations, because these three members of the human organization are related together in different ways during the various stages of life. During childhood, the soul and spiritual element works into the physical organization in a totally different way from what is happening during the older stages. It is essential to pay due attention to these subtle changes. However, if one is willing to develop the kind of mental imagery indicated above, one will gradually learn to broaden and deepen one's previous conception. I seem to have offended many readers of my book titled The Spiritual Guidance of Man and Mankind, when I drew attention to the fact that in the child there lives a kind of wisdom which the adult no longer possesses. I certainly do not wish to belittle the wisdom and the abilities of the adult, but just imagine what would happen if, at the early stage, when the brain and the other organs are still relatively unformed, it would depend on our personal wisdom only to permeate and to shape the entire organization, I am afraid we should fare rather badly. Certainly the child molds its brain and all the other organs entirely unconsciously, but great wisdom is at work there nonetheless. If you consider the entire course of human life, as described in the previous lectures, you will be able to recognize this wisdom, particularly so if you have a sense for what children's dreams can tell you. Adults tend to dismiss such dreams as childish nonsense. But if you can experience their underlying reality, these dreams, so different from adult dreams, are actually most interesting. Of course, the child is not able to express itself clearly when speaking about its dreams, but there are ways of finding out what it wants to tell us. And then we shall find that in its dreams, through images of spirit beings, the child dimly experiences the sublime powers of wisdom with the help of which it molds its brain and other physical organs. If we approach the child's dreams with reverence, which is in tune with its own experiences, we will recognize in them an all-pervading cosmic wisdom at work. From this point of view, forgive this somewhat harsh statement, the child is much wiser, much cleverer than the adult. And when the teacher enters the classroom, he should really be aware of this abundance of wisdom in the child. He himself has already outgrown it, and what he has gained instead, the knowledge of his own experience, is not in the least comparable with it. Adult dreams no longer have the same quality. The adult carries his everyday life into them. I have already spoken about this from a different point of view. When an adult dreams, he carries his day wisdom into his night life, where it reacts upon him in turn. But when a child dreams, a sublime wisdom streams through it. Though quite unconscious of what is happening, the child, nevertheless, retains a dim awareness upon waking up. And when, during the day, it sits at its school desk, it still has an indistinct feeling of this cosmic wisdom, but it cannot find it in the teacher. The teacher, on the other hand, feels superior to the child in matters of knowledge and wisdom. This is only natural, for otherwise he could not teach. He is conscious of his own wisdom, and from this point of view he is certainly superior. But his kind of wisdom is not as all-comprising and sublime as that of the child. If one were to put into words what is happening when the young child, pervaded by wisdom, meets the teacher who has lost this primordial wisdom, the following picture would emerge. Abstract knowledge, typical of our times, with which the teacher has been closely linked for so many years of his life, tends to turn him into a rather dry and pedantic adult. In some cases, already his demeanor and outer appearance reveal these traits. The child, on the other hand, has retained the freshness and sprightliness which spring from spiritual wisdom. When now the teacher enters his classroom, the child is made to control its high spirits. The teacher feels that he is intelligent and that his pupils are stupid. But in the subconscious realms of both teacher and pupils, quite a different picture emerges. And if dreams were allowed to speak as well, the picture again would be quite different. Somewhere in their subconscious, the children feel how stupid the teacher is, and in his subconscious realm the teacher feels how wise the children are. All this is part of the classroom atmosphere. It belongs to the imponderables which play a most important part in education. Because of this situation, the child cannot help confronting the teacher with a certain kind of arrogance, however slight, of which it remains completely unconscious. Its innate attitude toward the teacher is one of amusement, for it cannot help feeling how little of the flow of wisdom pervading its own body has survived in the teacher. Instinctively it contrasts its own wisdom with that of the teacher, as he enters the classroom somewhat stiff and pedantic, his expression grown morose from having lived long with abstract intellectual concepts, his coat so heavy with the dust of libraries that it defies the clothes brush. The uppermost feeling of the child at this sorry sight is one of mild amusement. This is how the teacher is seen with the eyes of the child, however unconscious the child may be. And we cannot help seeing a certain justification in its attitude. After all, such a reaction is a form of self-protection, preserving the child's state of health. A dream about its teachers would hardly be an elevating experience for the young pupil, who is still able to dream of the powers of wisdom which permeate its whole being. In the subconscious regions of the teacher, an opposite kind of feeling develops, which is also very real, and which, too, belongs to the imponderables of the classroom. In the case of the child, we can speak of a dim awareness, but in the teacher there lurks a subconscious desire. Though he will never admit this consciously, a yearning is rising up within him, a longing for the vitalizing forces of wisdom with which the child is blessed. If those who psychoanalyze human souls were more aware of spiritual realities than is usually the case, they would soon discover what an important part these vitalizing and fresh growing forces in the child, as well as the other human forces, are playing in the teacher's subconscious life. These are some of the imponderables pervading the classroom. And if one is able to look a little behind the scenes, one finds that the child turns away from the teacher because of a certain disenchantment. It dimly feels the unspoken question, what has become of all that streams and flows through me in this grown-up who is my teacher? In the teacher, on the other hand, subconscious longings begin to stir. Like a vampire, he wants to prey upon the young souls in his charge. If one were to look a little closer, one would detect how strongly, in many cases, this vampire-like urge works underneath an outwardly orderly appearance. Herein lies the origin of various tendencies toward ill health in young children. One only needs to look with open eyes at the psychological disposition of some teachers to recognize how such tendencies can result from daily life in the classroom. As teachers, we cannot overcome these harmful influences unless we are sustained by a knowledge of man which is imbued with love for humanity, a knowledge of man both mobile and alive, and in harmony with the human organism as I have described it. Only genuine love of man can overcome and balance the various forces in human nature which have become one-sided. Such knowledge of man also enables us to recognize not only how human nature expresses itself differently in different individuals, but also how it undergoes characteristic changes in childhood, maturity, and old age. For the three members of the human being have a completely different working relationship during the three main ages of life, and each member has to adapt itself accordingly. This needs to be borne in mind, especially when the timetable is made. Obviously, we must cater to the whole being of the child, to its head as well as to its limbs, and we must make allowances for the fact that in each of the three members, processes springing from the other two are also going on all the time. For example, metabolic processes are continually happening also in the head. If now the children have to sit still at their desks to do some head work, more of this later on, as also about the hygienic aspect of classroom desks, if their activities do not flow into their limbs and metabolism, we place them into a one-sided situation. This we must balance by allowing the head to relax later on, rightly so afterward, by allowing them to enjoy moving about in gym lessons. If one is conscious of the polar nature of the processes taking place in the head and in the limbs and metabolism, one will appreciate the importance of providing the right kind of change in the timetable. But if now, after a boisterous gym lesson, we take the pupils back into the classroom to continue our lessons, what do we do then? You must realize that while a person is engaged in limb activities which stimulate the metabolism, any thoughts that may have been artificially implanted in the head during previous years no longer remain there. When the child jumps and runs about, when it is active in limbs and metabolism, any thoughts previously planted in the head simply fly away. But those forces, which become manifest only in the child's dreams, the forces of supersensible wisdom, now enter the head region, claiming their rights. Well, if after a movement lesson we take the children back again to the classroom, in order to replace these forces by something else which must appear inferior to their subconscious minds, a mood of resentment will make itself felt in the class. For during the previous lesson, not only sense-perceptible, but above all, supersensible forces have been working upon the child. Pupils may not show unwillingness outwardly, but an inner resentment is certainly there. By resuming ordinary lessons after a movement lesson, we go against the child's nature, and by doing so, we implant potential seeds of illness in the child. This is a fact which, so a physiologist assured me, has been known for a considerable time. Here I have given you an explanation from the anthroposophical point of view, in order to show you how much lies in the teacher's hands to foster health in children, provided he has gained the right knowledge of man. Naturally, if we go about it in the wrong way, we will actually implant all kinds of illnesses in the child, and of this we must always be fully aware. As you may have noticed by now, I do not glorify in the usual kind of worldly wisdom so often highly prized in our days. That kind of wisdom would hardly suffice to shape and mold the inner organs of the young for their years to come. Had we not become stiff in our entire organization by the time we reach a mature age, with the result that all the knowledge we have impressed into our heads through naturalistic and intellectual concepts is thrown back in form of memory pictures, it would eventually stream down into our remaining organism. However absurd this may sound, if what under normal conditions belongs to the sphere of the head should stream down into limb and metabolic regions, the human being would become ill. For these head forces act like poison when they enter the lower spheres. Brain wisdom indeed becomes a kind of poison as soon as it enters the wrong sphere, at least as soon as it reaches the metabolism. The only way in which we can manage to live with this brain knowledge of ours, and I mean this quite concretely and not in any sense as a moral judgment, is by preventing this poison from entering our metabolic and limb system, for here it would have a devastating effect. But the child is not protected by this stiffness of the adult. If we impress our kind of knowledge into the child, we let our concepts invade and poison the child's metabolic and limb system. You see how important it is to realize from practical experience how much head knowledge we can expect a child to absorb without exposing it to the dangers of becoming poisoned in its metabolic and limb organization. And so, it lies in the teacher's hands to promote either health or illness in the child. If he insists on making pupils intellectually clever, according to present-day standards, if he crams their heads with all kinds of intellectual content, he will actually prevent the unconscious forces of wisdom from permeating the child. Cosmic wisdom, on the other hand, is immediately set in motion, when the child runs about, when it makes more or less rhythmical movements. Because of the unique position between head and limb metabolism, this rhythmic activity brings about bodily union with these cosmic forces of wisdom. Herbert Spencer was quite correct when he spoke about the negative effects of a monastic education, which aimed at making the young excel in intellectual achievements. For, so he pointed out, in later years these scholars would be unable to make use of their prowess of intellect, because during their school days they had been impregnated with the seeds of all kinds of illnesses. These are the matters which cannot be weighed accurately by some special scales. They reveal themselves only to an open attitude of mind, and to the kind of mobile thinking which can be developed through an anthroposophical schooling, a thinking which must always remain in touch with practical life. So much about the importance of the teacher making himself acquainted with the fundamentals governing both health and illness in the human being. And here it must be emphasized, once again, that in order to avoid becoming entrapped by external criteria and by immobile and fixed concepts, one must learn to recognize the ever-changing processes in human nature, which always tend toward either health or illness. These the teacher will meet in his classes, and he must learn how to deal with them rightly. Further details will be given when we shall focus our attention on the changing stages of the child, of the growing human being. The end of Lecture 6.